what is unique about ballot measures is these are issues that go before us. We get to make a choice. We get to make the choice for our community. And that is another throng of a really what I believe makes a thriving democracy.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. I've been speaking with some representatives of a new generation of progressive leaders who bring focus on equity and partnership with grassroots organizations to the management of existing progressive institutions. One such leader is Chris Melody Fields Figueredo, who is the executive director of BISC, the Ballot Initiative Strategy Center. BISC is the piece of the progressive ecosystem that works to make ballot measures a part of a larger progressive strategy to strengthen and improve our democracy and improve governance. Chris and I had a very good discussion about her work, the politics of the current ballot initiative landscape, and her approach to management. I think it's well worth your listen. So, after a quick word with our sponsor, my interview with Chris with BISC.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from TimePlots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. TimePlots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Chris, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. My name is Chris Melody Fields Figueredo. I'm the executive director of the Ballot Initiative Strategy Center, a national organization that is building a progressive strategy that is rooted in people and in building state-based power when it comes to ballot measures. You know, I grew up in Texas. I was born in Venezuela, came to the U.S. around 3, and I come from an immigrant background. I come from a working class family, and that's really shaped my life and my career of, you know, having to sit around the table with my parents and figuring out college and school and opportunities that would build our family. One of the things that had the most impact on my life was public education. Being able to go to really great schools and having really phenomenal teachers and wanting that experience for everyone. And actually, when I went to college, I wanted to be a teacher, and that's what I thought my path was going to be for a long time. You know, I didn't grow up in a politically active family. My dad was a maintenance manager for a printing company. My mom cleaned houses. So politics wasn't something that was infused in our family, but it was infused in our lives because there were people making decisions for our family. And my dad was definitely a nerd and brought a lot of history, and we talked about history. And so I always just kind of had a desire for that, whether I knew it or not. I was in college when September 11th happened and the Iraq War happened, and I started to get really involved in student government, and that sort of started and wet my palate of being in politics. You know, by the time I got to senior year, I made a different decision for myself. And, you know, I graduated in the middle of when a presidential campaign was happening in 2004. And, you know, I had started my political activism on campus in the anti-war efforts. And that led me to working on my first presidential campaign. And throughout my career, you know, for a good chunk and where I got my start was working on different candidate races, from presidential to state Senate to U.S. Senate races. But what I started to realize for me, it was less about the politics. It was about the people and people having a voice. And I really saw especially being a queer Latinx woman, but specifically working in the South, of how we had built a system to actually not be inclusive of all people, and specifically Black and Brown folks. And that really sparked my interest in wanting to address the issues that wasn't creating a truly representative and inclusive democracy. And so that sort of fast forwarded me into working for more issue advocacy organizations. So, you know, I worked at Common Cause at a point in my career. I've always wanted to work around government. I didn't want to work for government. I didn't want to work on the Hill. I didn't want to work at the White House, because I really wanted to be rooted in people and community. And that is really what drives me. I worked at Common Cause on money and politics and redistricting and voting rights and really in addressing these issues around our democracy. And, you know, for me, I was often in places as the only person of color, in really white spaces. And that sort of started my trajectory of getting more involved from a racial justice and racial equity lens, of the people who need to be supported the most are the ones who are very much left out of the process and the systems that ultimately were not created for Black and Brown people. We're not created for women. We're not created for queer folks. Like, that isn't how these systems were built, but the idea around democracy is such a fundamentally important thing. So, you know, I went to work for the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, and for many years ran an election protection program and state-based working with amazing grassroots organizations. There were two things that I saw when I was at the Lawyers Committee. One, around communications and how we were talking to people about the issues, specifically around voting rights, and we're often only talking about the really hard obstacles, which are real, and they're very real right now as folks are voting right now and participating in our democracy. But we weren't talking about it in an aspirational and hopeful way that motivated people and got them activated. So then I went to Rethink Media to really work on a much more coordinated voting rights strategy. But when 2016 happened for me as a queer Latinx woman of color, what I saw was, at that particular moment and what is happening right now, I am the very person who should be leading an organization. And it's not something that I always knew I wanted to do, but when I saw the position at the Ballot Initiative Strategy Center, I saw so many things that I had done throughout my career, you know, wanting someone who had experience working in racial equity, working with building state-based power. And I said, actually, a friend and now, you know, then was on the board, said, you should put your hat in. I thought, why not? Who knows? Let's go on this journey. And through the course of that, I knew the only way I could lead I was very clear in my leadership. Black and Brown people would be centered. Racial equity would be our North Star. And that was what was missing in the ballot measure space, was actually the people who are impacted by these ballot measures, whether it's on voting rights, whether it's on paid, you know, family leave, whether it's on reforming our criminal legal systems. They are often not part of the process of determining the solutions that will impact the outcome of their lives. And I had to be very clear that was the shift that had to happen to truly live up to the mission of the organization. And that really has led me to where I am now, leading the organization and how we've approached, as a national organization, being in deep partnership with grassroots organizations who know the solutions. They're the closest to the pain. They have to be a part of the conversations from the beginning, and how that impacts and what are the race equity choices that we have to make as we're building these campaigns, as we're training folks, as we're, you know, deciding who's going to lead this campaign, the messages that we have, how we conduct civic engagement. That has to be a through line, and we have to think about the entirety of the process to build really grassroots state-based power that fundamentally transform the way the systems that we build and the way that we govern in this country. And that's what we're trying to do now.
Do you think that the board that hired you, that they got what they wanted?
Well, I was very clear on who I was going to be. And I mean, I think that's been part of my own leadership development in the last 2 years. You know, there are a couple of people who I look up to, Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw, who created the intersectional theory and that framework of how I am queer, I am Latinx, I'm a woman, I'm the daughter of an immigrant, I'm all of these things at the same time, yet we've created systems that don't allow us to be our whole selves. So I made that decision that I couldn't hide any of those things. And I had to be very clear, especially in the interview process, that that is how I was going to lead, was from my own lived experience. And even in the progressive movement, right, like it has been very white dominant for the entirety of the movement. But the people who are the most impacted are Black and Brown, and they are queer. You know, the people who have been pushed to the margins are the lives that we are so rooted in, but they haven't been the face of the movement. So I was very clear through the interview process that that would be my center and that would be the way I would lead. I also, you know, came from a different background of fundraising and, you know, working in the, more civic engagement type of organizations and approaching, you know, I was very clear, like that was something different that I was going to bring. They knew what they were getting. I was very clear about that, but you know, how that plays out in reality, especially being a queer woman of color, like there were challenges, certainly in my first 2 years. I'm not even putting that on the board. I'm putting that within the movement and how, even in fundraising, like, you know, how all of this has been created in a white dominant culture, it wasn't built for me. And so I've had to push to make and shift the culture, well, still working on it, but that allows for my type of leadership. So yeah, I was very clear. It has been met with a lot of challenges, but you know, what I'm very thankful for is my staff, my team has always had my back 100% of the way. I've had board members that have had my back 100% of the way. I've had folks in the movement 100% of the way. And I had to focus on those folks at the times where other people made me feel unworthy and that I was doing something wrong. I always had to do that check because I am worthy. You know, I was born worthy of this, even though the culture and the system wasn't built for me. I have to carve my space within it and shift it and change it. And what I talk about with my staff all the time now, especially in the moment that we are in, with radical reimagination, because it was never built for me and people like me from the inception.
Can you say a word or two about the mission of your center?
Absolutely. So the Ballot Initiative Strategy Center, we're a national organization, but we're not actually the ones running the initiatives. We are providing the support to the grassroots leaders, to the organizations, to the campaign throughout that ballot measure process. So, you know, our mission is to strengthen our democracy by implementing a national progressive strategy for ballot measures that is rooted in building state-based power, right? So how do we do that? We do that through analysis and tracking the ballot measure landscape, seeing what these issues that are coming before voters. We provide assistance to ballot measure campaigns. So that's when somebody has a question, I'm like, how do I set up the governance around this ballot measure? Or, hey, how do I set up this research? You know, they come to us and we walk them through that process to protecting the process itself. As we have been able to be you know, quite successful in winning progressive issues at the ballot. Over the last two election cycles, the process itself for citizens to gather signatures and put issues in front of voters, that process itself has been attacked. And so we work on that as well. We train folks. And this is something I really believe in, you know, how we build a pipeline is how we invest and train folks to develop throughout the leadership pipeline. We do research, and we've been very focused on looking at research in a non-binary way, looking at research that is focusing on Black, Latinx, Asian Pacific Islander, and this year with our pre and post-election research, we're adding Native folks in that research to ensure that the strategies that we develop and the way we work with folks are centering those communities through ballot measures. And then a huge role that we play is convening and facilitating, right? Like, we are often that honest broker within a campaign or a coalition that can have these really difficult conversations. If you've done coalition work, you know, there's some thorny times, but we can be that honest broker with folks as they're going through those thorny issues. And then the fundamentally most important thing is centering in our North Star is racial equity. And that means challenging systemic racism and ensuring those who have been oppressed are centered at every moment through that process.
Can you give me just a sense of the landscape of initiatives? How many states have the ability to do initiative? And when you kind of look at it globally, is it something that is more helpful to the progressive side or the conservative side?
About half of the country plus DC has what is called the citizen initiated process. So that means people go into their communities, gather signatures to put issues before voters, right? A good chunk of it is out west. So states like California, Washington State, Oregon, Arizona, Colorado. And then, you know, you have a very small concentration in the South, like Florida and Mississippi are one of the only two states in the South, and then a handful in the Midwest, in the Northeast. And that's part of the history of where ballot measures started. They started out West in California over 100 years ago. When corporations had essentially the railroad barons had taken over the California state legislature, right, and had completely taken over the political system. And it was very hard for issues to go. And it came out of the progressive era. You know, flash forward to today, now what we're seeing, in addition to citizen initiated, we're seeing a lot more state legislative referrals. So a state legislature will refer a constitutional amendment to the ballot, like we're seeing in a lot of southern states that will, you know, be codified into the state constitution. We're seeing that at a higher rate than we've seen it before. You know, whether it's a more progressive or conservative, the reason why BISC was created, because there was not a coordinated progressive strategy to take things through the ballot a measure process. So, you know, there were a number of attacks around reproductive health, around LGBTQ issues, around attacks on the labor movement, the environment. Those were all clearly very coordinated by the right, but there wasn't that same strategy to fight back on the progressive side. And so that's why we were created. And the time that we were playing defense, you know, this is what BISC also saw the need to actually create an affirmative proactive agenda to, rather than play defense, let's play offense and take the issues, whether it's raising the minimum wage or ensuring increasing voting rights or, you know, addressing mass incarceration. We had to create the strategy to take those issues to the voters. And, you know, we started that strategy about 6-7 years ago, before my time as executive director. From the field, we heard that, you know, issues around our democracy and the economy were the most salient for their communities. And they also intersected. in a lot of ways, that it became part of our own strategy as an organization working with folks to take these issues before the ballot. So, you know, issues around same-day registration or automatic voter registration or redistricting or raising the minimum wage, paid family leave. Those are ultimately what have been strategies for the last several years. And we've been winning on those issues. And now sort of the next phase is, now how do we take that same proactive strategy on these structural systemic issues? This year we see issues around abolition of slavery as a form of punishment that is going before voters in Utah and Nebraska. That's deeply connected to how mass incarceration has essentially put more Black and brown folks in the prison system. We're seeing issues around paid family leave, which is going before voters in Colorado. We're seeing the minimum wage, which is going before voters in Florida. We're seeing affirmative action, which is going before voters in California. So, you know, now it's the next chapter. And what I said earlier, what is the radical reimagination we need right now to address these issues that we've seen time and time again? The energy around the Black Lives Matter movement, and reimagining what community safety and public safety means, around the conversations around divest, invest. Like, how are we now taking that before voters to make those decisions? And so that's sort of the next phase.
If you had to pick the couple most crucial initiatives this year, 2020, to defeat, if you could wave your magic wand, and the couple that you would most want to see success with, what would they be?
Prop 22 in California, which is known as the gig economy. This is the Uber and Lyft, the ballot initiative that Uber and Lyft have are putting before voters, that would fundamentally shift how workers are protected in the state of California, and essentially creating a second or subclass of workers. And these workers are predominantly Black and brown, immigrant, and they would not have protections on around paid leave, around sexual harassment, around compensation. That is a potentially game changer for workers' rights, not just the United States, but globally. I think what makes that particular measure even more alarming, for the California state legislature to make any changes, it would require 7/8 approval.
What?
Name a legislature in the country that makes it almost virtually impossible to make changes. And I think that is ultimately an attack on democracy and people and representative government.
So does it take only 50% to put it in place?
Mm-hmm. I mean, look at what Florida is doing. In 2018, what I would argue is one of the most transformational ballot measures that we've seen in this country around restoration of voting rights for formerly incarcerated folks, it approved overwhelmingly 64% of the vote. In the state of Florida, to make a constitutional amendment, you already have to have 60% of the vote. That is more than it takes any candidate. There is already a high bar. Now there's what I would argue is a bad amendment for before voters in Florida, where it would have to be passed in two election cycles before there could be an amendment to the Constitution. So it essentially makes it impossible to have any voter. It would be one of the most regressive ballot measure laws in the country. So after over, you know, 64% of Floridians making a choice of giving people second chances, 2 years later, there's a campaign to take the will away from the people. If you go to Missouri, in 2018, voters overwhelmingly passed a ballot measure that would reform redistricting, ethics, money and politics in that state. Overwhelmingly, passed more than 60% of the vote. The state legislature now, there is a ballot measure that would undo almost everything that that ballot measure intended that is going before voters. And what is particularly problematic about that ballot measure is it essentially lays the groundwork for challenging how we have drawn districts in this country for over a century around one person, one vote. I look at those as like fundamental game changers of what democracy means and what representative democracy means and what people power means within this country. Do not be fooled that any of these ballot measures are actually intended to help people. It is actually to silence the very people who our democracy is intended to represent. On the plus side, right, we have paid family and medical leave before Colorado voters. That is a great thing that's before Colorado voters. Minimum wage going before voters in Florida that will essentially over the next several years grow the minimum wage, which is around a little over $8 per hour in the state of Florida, to $15 per hour. All of these things in the middle of a pandemic, that is potentially immediate relief for folks. So ranked choice voting, that'll be before voters in Massachusetts. There are really important issues that will like immediately change people's lives come November. In addition to voting for the president, federal government, state government, local government, all are important. But what is unique about ballot measures is these are issues that go before us. We get to make a choice. We get to make the choice for our community. And that is another throng of a really what I believe makes a thriving democracy.
So it sounds like you, despite the fact that the initiative campaigns are vulnerable to a lot of things that are dangerous, like the right can use them, they can be funded by large amounts of money, that you think in general that they're a good part of the system?
I think anything is only as good as the support we give to people. And what I mean by that, if you look like at a good part of where ballot measures don't exist, the South, is where we have not made it investments in education, the economy, jobs, having fundamental protections for people, where we have not developed the infrastructure, right? Like, I very much believe, yes, ballot measures are a really critical part of our democracy. Yes, I think it's important. I think it is absolutely a beautiful tool for the people, but I would never give people a tool that there is not infrastructure and support behind it.
You talked quite a bit about what you wanted to bring to the role of being ED. What have you learned from your time in that role?
I really wanted to think about what makes an organization run well. And it's, you know, thinking about the finances, it's thinking about the operations, it's thinking about the development, it's thinking about the program. And I really wanted to build an organization that thought about the whole. And it didn't matter what position you were within the organization, you are vital to ensuring that that organization has the continuity and growth necessary to execute its mission. Like, that was really important to me. I didn't know, you know, like, I knew a little bit, I knew how to write a budget, obviously I've done it in my career. I knew about, you know, finance, but I really, for me, it was so important to like, take that whole view and then trust my staff to execute. And my role is to give them the strategy and the vision and support in order to deliver on what is expected. People told me who were previously executive directors is how lonely this job can be. And I have phenomenal staff who totally 100% support me, but you're making organizational decisions that affect people's lives. Like, literally whether a person has a job, that is a lot to hold. And so like the weight of that, even though people had told me, I didn't recognize how hard that would be, especially this particular year where we're dealing with a racial reckoning and I have a majority of staff of color, including myself, almost an all female identifying team. Like the weight of this year has been incredibly difficult in the middle of a pandemic and like building the plane as we're going, like figuring out how to run an organization in the middle of a pandemic. Those were all things I never thought I would have to do. But what I've also learned is when you lead with vulnerability, which I don't think is how we are taught, because I think a lot of people say that's a sign of weakness. Actually, that is how you get people on board and how you mobilize people to your vision and feel a connection that is so incredibly important to doing this job. That has been very, very important for myself to lead with vulnerability, to open that space for staff to also feel they can be vulnerable and be their whole selves, which, and I hope an impact has been that other leaders and other people in the nonprofit progressive space see that to fundamentally fulfill all of our missions, we have to be a whole person and not have to hide any piece of ourselves, and that we're only going to get the best out of people when they feel supported and they feel they can be their full selves at any place that we work. You know, I've come in a space where, like, you know, family and work are separate. There are times in my life where I made those choices that those had to be separate, but that isn't the type of organization that I wanted to lead. And I wanted to create that space for people too. And the other important thing is how important developing an aspirational budget is. It's telling a story of where you're taking the organization and your vision of what it means to fund that organization to succeed, and really removing what I think plagues the nonprofit sector immeasurably is a scarcity mentality of like, well, I don't have the money yet, so I can't put that in the budget, and I don't know if that's going to be right. I had to remove that. I'm always constantly thinking about raising revenue and diversifying our revenue, but I also have to tell, in order to raise money, I got to show what the money is that is necessary to build this organization. And that I think is something that we're not always told about when we think about these leader positions, of how actually really important the development of that budget is to get to your vision and to execute on your mission.
That strikes me as a pretty evolved perspective on leadership, especially the stuff about vulnerability. I'm curious if you have found a way to have support in that from peers, from coaches, from other resources in the progressive ecosystem. Because when I was running an organization, I definitely found places where leaning on others that were in similar roles helped a lot.
I could not have done this without a group of executive directors who were all people of color, Black, Latinx, South Asian, Asian Pacific Islander. Like, we all became EDs relatively around the same time. I could not have done this without them.
Is that a like an informal group?
We all were like, oh my gosh. It's like, you know, a couple of us had a conversation, right? Or, you know, like a friend, you know, several of them are my, like, friends, literal friends who, like, I go and do Halloween with kids, right? Or text to about, like, life stuff to who are, like, not just peers, they are, like, people who are in my life. So it's very informal. And one of the reasons why is there are phenomenal leadership programs out there. One of which I was very blessed to be a part of, Rockwood Leading from the Inside Out. I was so blessed for my first year as an executive director to go through that program with peers who were grappling with similar issues as me. I could not have developed my vision for the organization without them. But also what was different, or at least what's different about this space, is it was created by us and for us. So where there are other leadership phenomenal programs out there that are so beautiful and many of us have gone through, you know, I think of other leadership programs or coaches that are there. What was different for this is, like, one, we were all executive directors. We were all in our first 2-3 years, some of which, like, literally were like, I'm going to be an executive director next month. But we all knew each other because we worked in the progressive movement together, but specifically we're Black and brown folks working in the progressive movement together. And we created that space for us, what we needed. Two particular things that I think is transformational about that space is we lead with radical love with each other. And one, well, I'll give 100% credit to Maurice Mitchell, who's the director of the Working Families Party, infused within us is radical generosity, where we know the hardships of being an executive director and asking a funder for money, or like having a huge budget gap. And we go into those meetings and we support each other. We call out each other on stage and we lead, we support each other through radical generosity, where if one of us is down, then we're all down and we got to support each other. And we have, you know, conversations about, like, how do you develop this personnel policy? It's like, it's so beautiful to be in a space where you can ask your, like, people who you built community with first and trust each other that will have your back to be able to lead in the way that you want to.
That makes all kind of sense to me. When you think about allies in the political space for what you do as a center, who comes to mind?
Peer organizations who I think of are, you know, the State Innovation Exchange. Six is led by Jesse Uwabari and Neha Patel, who are modeling what co-leadership and being co-executive directors means. I think of State Voices and the leadership of Alexis Anderson Reed, which, you know, their state tables provide civic engagement support across the progressive movement. I think of Alliance for Youth Action that provides support and has a network of young leaders. I think of, you know, also from the issue-based organizations of folks who are trying to fundamentally change how we approach organizing and building political power, like the Working Families Party, led by Maurice Mitchell. I think of, you know, folks who come where I feel we have not been able to make the advancements around gun violence prevention because a lot of the national organizations that exist are not led by Black and brown people, and Black and brown people feel gun violence at a much higher level. So I think about Amber Goodwin at the Community Justice Action Fund. And these are also happen to be my peers in this, in the group that I described before. Like, those are all who I think are our partners and our allies in doing the work differently in the way BISC approaches the work, not from a place of transactional work, but actually leading with for transformational impact that will fundamentally, you know, change people's mind. I mean, I could name a million more. Karundi Williams from Repower, Justin Myers at For Our Future. Like, these folks are just all amazing Black and brown folks that are leading national organizations very much from their own lived experience and are fundamentally trying to change the way we do politics and progressive work in this country.
With all those examples that you cite, should I be feeling optimistic about the way progressive organizations are transforming leadership, or are we really a long way off from where we should be?
I think we've made progress. You should absolutely have hope, because there is this new generation of leaders within the progressive movement. And I didn't even talk about all the dope, like, amazing folks on the state leading, like, amazing grassroots organizations like Alex Gomez and Tomas Robles in Arizona. at Lucha, or Andrea Mercado, who's leading New Florida Majority, or Tram Nguyen, who's leading Virginia New Majority. Like, there's just such amazing stuff that is happening both at the state and national level. All people who are Black and Brown, who have either immigrant backgrounds or are queer, and like live that in full body. So there is so much hope, but we are still working within a white dominant culture that was not built for us. That's super hard. We're still not funded at the level that our white peers. We are questioned at every turn when we try to implement a program or try to push back or make a change. Many of us are still like raising money to execute program literally right now. So yes, there is hope because we are in these positions and we lead in these ways, but we also have to fundamentally change the culture within the progressive movements and in our country that is steeped in white supremacy and structural racism.
When you think about the upcoming election 2020 more broadly, how does the ballot stuff that you're tracking fit into the larger narrative?
One of the things that we have seen and why our research focuses on voters of color is because we have seen that these issues are highly motivating to folks and actually are a higher proposition or a reason for folks to go out and vote than some of the candidates. Our 2018 research, you found that 63% of voters of color found that voting on ballot measures was more effective than voting on candidates. And that number increased to 68 or 69% for young Black men. So they absolutely have a huge role in what it means to engage low propensity or low turnout voters. They are people who we don't talk to. It is not their fault. They have not felt motivated to vote. We have not presented them with choices that will motivate them to vote. Yes, candidates are important. Yes, at the local, state, and federal level, absolutely fundamentally and important. But we're also not presenting them with folks from their own communities that then deliver on the promises they made on during the campaign. I look at ballot measures as an accountability tool. You know, 63-64% of Floridians voted for second chances and voted for the restoration of voting rights. And then the state legislature turned around and tried to completely undermine that. And it's been in litigation ever since. For me, that's an accountability tool where you are fundamentally not listening. You, state legislator, state senator, are not listening to the very people who you are supposed to represent in government. So I think they play a very interdependent and intersected role within everything that is at stake, not just this election, but everything moving forward and the radical reimagination that is required to fundamentally change this country, to actually live to the ideals that we have never lived up to of all people are free and created equal. I do absolutely think they play a critical role within this larger idea of what it means to have people-centered democracy.
Chris, is there a question that I haven't asked that you wish I had?
Where do people go to find out more? Would be one. If you're thinking about viewers, what is their role within this? If they agree with my vision and my call to action to folks would be raise the questions that I raised of like, what does it mean to have an inclusive democracy? How am I, as a white progressive, maybe not living into the values of the movement, and how am I making space for Black and Brown folks to lead? In order for all of this to work, I think is that call to action of people understanding you have a role and a part, what I believe is transforming the progressive movement.
If people want to help you, where should they go?
Well, if you want to learn more about BIS, Our website is Ballot, www.ballot.org. You can follow us on Twitter at Ballot Strategy, Facebook Ballot Initiative Strategy Center. You know, if you want to follow me, I'm trying to get better. Instagram is my my social media platform of choice because I love photography, and that's my one of my many side hustles is photography. But at Field Z would be how you follow me, and whenever I remember to say something, I'm trying to get better at it. That's where you can find BISC in the phenomenal work, the badass team that I have the pleasure of leading, as well as we also lift up our partners on the ground. Those are a couple of places, and that call to action before is asking yourself, what am I doing to advance the radical reimagination that is necessary to take on what has prevented us from progressing forward, which is white supremacy and structural racism? That's the question anybody should be asking. And the follow-up to that, it is not on Black and brown people alone to address this fundamental challenge within our movements and our country.
Chris, it's an honor to talk to you today.
Thank you.
Is there anything else you want to say?
No, it was a pleasure talking to you, and look forward to future conversations. And vote would be the last thing I would say. That's the last word.
I'm with you there. So that was Chris with BISC. She's at ballot.org. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.